I'd like to do the class today pretty much the way I did it last week, namely to do the review at the beginning, pause on any questions that you may have on that material that we covered the last time, and then move into the new discussion and to let ask your leave once again to let me go through the whole of that material on the healing vector with questions only if I've lost you or you need repeating or I'm going too fast. And then towards the end, hopefully, if we get through it, there would be time for more comprehensive questions. But I think it's much more effective if I can present that material as a unit. So, first of all, then, with regard to the review from last time, what we treated in the last class was most of the material under number 2A on the outline on the creative vector. I touched only briefly on number 4 there, the dilemma of moral impotence, and I will go into that in more detail today, but the class was devoted to the discussion of 1, 2, and 3 in some detail. Very briefly, I talked about the 5 levels of consciousness, moving from below upwards, empirical, intelligent, rational, existential, and that level of consciousness where we rest. We're going to talk more about that today, but one of the dimensions of that 5th level is, of course, the mystical prayer, resting in the love of God. And I emphasized how our experience changes as we move from one level to the next. Different. It's a different experience. And how those operations that we perform at the different levels are shot through with affectivity, feeling. And how the feeling changes from one level to the next. You feel different when you're confused and when you understand. Or when you are asking for the truth and when you are convinced that you found it. When you're trying to make a decision and then you've made it. Or you're looking for God and then you've found Him. Feeling is different. So our experience, our affectivity changes as we move from one level to the next.
I don't quite understand how what you just said follows what you just said. The pre and the post of each stage is acutely distinct. Mm-hmm. Searching for an answer, receiving the answer. How is that different at each stage, though? How is the pre-feeling of each stage different from the pre-feeling of any of the stages?
Okay, it is different, huh? You feel differently if your experience is one simply of chaotic impressions. Okay, then you move to the insight, which organizes those, okay?
That's the pre and the post.
All right, now, here you've got an insight, which may possibly be true, so your experience is not as chaotic.
But it is still chaotic relative to the next
stage. Yeah. But it's not as chaotic as if there is nothing going on.
I see then more of a qualitative difference than a quantitative difference.
Oh yeah, I'm talking about a qualitative difference. That's what I'm talking about. It's a different experience.
Yeah, I think I said that backwards. It seems like a difference of intensity. It's the same feeling.
I don't
it's
believe
it's chaos at a new level.
I don't believe it is the same feeling.
Okay, that's the distinction that I'm asking for then.
Okay, that's the one I'm trying to point out. If you have a possible intelligibility, but you are trying to discern whether or not that possibility is in fact the truth, you're feeling there, sure, there's one of uncertainty. But it is very different from the fact that, from the experience, from the feeling that you have, if you don't have a clue as to what might even be going on. It's a very different experience.
I'm not trying to grant you that too quickly. Just by you saying that, it doesn't ring a bell.
Well, I don't know what else I can do. There's no...
Yeah, it becomes empirical at that point.
That's right. That's
right. Quality of that.
There's no syllogism by which I can prove that.
No, it's empirical.
I'm asking you to attend to your own experience and say whether or not it's correct. If you know that that something is true, you've affirmed that, and you're trying to decide what to do about it, I think that your experience is different from what it is if you don't yet know what the truth is. And you're not even ready to raise the question for decision. It's different. It is different. It's fuller. It's a fuller experience than if you're down here somewhere. But it is a matter of you testing that against your own experience. Saying whether or not that's correct. I think it is a different experience. All right. Now, so those operations are shot through with feeling, and that feeling has got to be free. It has got to be what we call self-transcendent. It's got to be detached. It has to be not bound up in disturbance. If we're going to be able to perform those operations in a smooth, uninterrupted, relatively undisturbed fashion. If the feeling is blocked along the way, it blocks the performance of the operations. And our feeling can be blocked because it is distributed into complexes and those complexes may be derailing us from the performance of the operations by which we seek meaning, truth, decision. Our psychic energy can be locked into inflexible patterns, resistances, anxieties, compulsions, obsessions. Don't feel the creative movement of our lives moving forward in a relatively undisturbed, unblocked fashion. These complexes, as we know, vary in depth. They may be so strong and so deeply rooted that they can make us unable to perform the operations that we need to perform in certain situations, unable to raise a question, to face a question. All of those blockages are victims. Those psychic blockages are victims of others, or perhaps of our own mistreatment of ourselves through our own unintelligent, unreasonable, irresponsible behavior. Let me finish the These victims, these victimized complexes, for those of you who know Jung, form what he calls the shadow. The shadow is that dark side of the psyche that interferes with the person's functioning and the performance of his or her responsibilities. The shadow, as I understand it, as I'm trying to present it, is a victim either of history, either of the sin of the world, or of personal sin. But the shadow itself is not personal sin. Victim. It's what's formed by sin, either the sin of others or the sin of the world as it has affected us or my own personal sin. Now, in either case, whether it's a victim of history or a victim of self or a combination of that, we usually treat the shadow in one of two ways, either by repressing it, denying its existence, or by acting it out, directly expressing its contorted energies. And to treat it that way simply victimizes it further. Those energies are meant to find some kind of creative expression in our lives. If they are repressed, if they are bottled up inside, they are not finding an outlet at all. They're not finding creative expression. They're not making the contribution that they could make. But if they're simply acted out in their distorted fashion, that is simply reinforcing the victimization, the rut, the pattern that they're already in. So whether I repress or whether I directly act out a distorted emotional complex, I'm further victimizing it. And also contributing to the victimization of others to the extent that I act out of irresponsible way of treating myself. There's self-hatred that's involved in self-destructiveness, self-victimization. And within a religious context, we're not treating our own emotions the way God would treat them. If the attitude that we adopt towards them is one of self-hatred, not treating the victims the way God would treat the victims. And then I suggested the third way, a third alternative. Namely, to recognize that what I'm dealing with are emotions that have been hurt and that are weak and powerless. And so to adopt an attitude towards my own emotional darkness of compassion. And then out of that compassion, letting there emerge a willingness to cooperate with whatever forces are available to transform those energies, to bring them into the light, and let the energy bound up in those complexes be redirected the creative movement of the mind. There are many ways of doing that, and we'll be talking about those when I get into the treatment of dreams and the interpretation of dreams and what Jung calls active imagination and so on. Cooperating with, negotiating the darkness in a way that dissolves its blocked energy and releases that energy into the creative movement of life. A victimized complex will respond to that kind of treatment. Now, the whole problem, of course, is the one that we touched on at the very end, which I'm going to go into in detail in a moment, namely the difficulty in bringing ourselves to do precisely that, to adopt that third posture. But I'd like to stop there and see if there are any questions.
You spoke of the complexes in real energy terms and their maintenance. So I'm wondering, where do we teach them? Where is this real energy?
The energy is the psyche itself is a matter of, this is my hypothesis, of energy.
Real energy.
Of real energy. In the same sense of the energy that Einstein described as E equals MC squared. It's real energy.
Have to be somewhere in the real world.
Yeah. And where it is in our psyche.
Where's that? I mean, real energy has to be touchable, like by an electrode is necessary, but so to speak. Where do we keep this real energy?
You find it in your psychic experience. See? Where is it? It's in your...
Yeah, actually where? Physically?
In your body. Where else?
Okay.
Where else? That's
okay.
Right.
You just never mentioned that part of it. That there's an actual bioenergetic component of that.
Okay. Take a few things for granted.
I know.
Any other questions?
Are you going to be talking about all this from a more positive viewpoint also, which is our complexes in our psyche that facilitates self-transcendence?
Yes, yeah. I think particularly when we get into dreams. Yes, sir.
I was thinking that in psychology, like depression and disorder, is there a common
When we move on later on in the outline there, I'm going to be talking about a balance in consciousness between the technical terminology is between limitation and transcendence. Finding the creative balance between those two in our consciousness. And when our consciousness is overly imbalanced in the direction of limitation, that's when you run into depression on the far end of that. And when it's overly imbalanced in the direction of transcendence, at the far end, schizophrenia. To set that whole thing up is going to take a little bit of work, but that's where. And the balance, the creative balance between the two, is the path along which we find direction in life. It's anticipating what we're talking about. Okay. The dilemma then of moral impotence. 284. The third posture of recognizing that the complexes have been victimized, treating them with compassion and letting there emerge a desire, a willingness to cooperate in their transformation, is a posture that is intelligent, reasonable, responsible. But the problem is that our psyches may be disordered to such an extent that we are unable to be intelligent, reasonable, morally responsible. The psychic disorder is such that it prevents intelligent, rational, responsible treatment. That's exactly what makes it a disorder. To be intelligent, rational, responsible is to be self-transcendent, not to be locked in an inflexible pattern. But that's precisely what's negated by the power of the complex. The power negates the possibility of self-transcendent behavior. And particularly, if I'm caught in a pattern of self-hatred, if I despise myself because of my weaknesses, if I despise the weaknesses of myself, then the willingness to compassionate myself is missing. The willingness to cooperate for their good is missing to the extent that my attitude towards my own darkness is one of self-hatred, self-destructive stance in its regard. If I hate a dimension of myself, I may or may not be reflectively aware of the fact that I do, but if I do, then to be willing to do something for its good is precisely what I cannot do. That self-hatred is in the way. So, there are two, at least up to this point, two possible sources of moral impotence, of inability to deal intelligently, rationally, responsibly with my own darkness. One of them is simply the power of the darkness itself, which prevents intelligence, rationality, responsibility. That's exactly what you mean by the darkness. It's in the way. It prevents that. It overwhelms me. That would be one obstacle. And then if I hate that darkness, if I hate the weakness, then I'm not really willing to be compassionate in its regard. Another way of coming at it. The darkness would have to be already somewhat healed for me to be willing to take a part in healing it further. It would already have to be somewhat healed for me to be able to take a stance that would cooperate with other healing powers. It has to be somewhat free, somewhat liberated from its binding power. And some of the darkness in myself may be so powerful and so distorted that that degree of freedom is simply not there. It's nice to see. I can be in the state of being, you know, under the grip of those dark emotions. And someone else may say, hey, wait a minute. Back up. Relax. And I may simply not be able to listen to what that person is saying because the power of the emotion is so strong. Yes.
Is that like leave the kind of a real hopelessness of the situation?
Mm-hmm.
There's just no hope that you could ever be good in yourself. So you've always got that lack of hope so that you never can achieve something.
Unless something else happens. And that's what we're getting to. And another way of dealing with the same thing, of talking about the same thing, is that the power of the emotion may be so strong that I cannot regard it as simply a part of myself. It's overwhelming me. It's taking over everything. And I can't disengage it and say, now wait a minute, that anger or hostility or whatever it is that I feel, that's not the whole of it. Yet I'm unable to take that objective stance with regard to it and engage it as simply a part of my whole makeup. It has overwhelmed my conscious makeup. It has taken over everything, and I can't step back from it and objectify it and say, now wait just a minute. What is going on? Or talk to it and say, who are you? Or where do you come from? And why are you doing that? But it may be so powerful that I can't do that. The power gets in the way. Blocks the freedom to treat it objectively. To take compassion on it. Different ways of coming at the same thing with regard to the step is a reasonable step to take, and yet I can't do it. I'm unable to do it. I have to be somewhat free of the emotion in order to get a stance that is independent of the emotion. You see what I'm getting at here? To be somewhat free of it in order to take a stance in its regard that is somewhat independent. And I can say, now wait just a minute. I don't want to be carried along by this. I want to be able to step back and negotiate that emotion. Jung talks about active imagination. One of the things that I can do in active imagination is to take an emotional complex and give it a name, personify it, and start talking to it, and listen to it. Give it a name. And then say, now, why are you feeling the way you're feeling? And let it talk it out. And as it talks it out, that energy is dissolved from its blockage. And I'm back in the state where I can start being who I want to be. But if the complex is so powerful that it has taken over the whole of my consciousness, I can't do this. I don't have the emotional freedom to be able to do it. Yes.
Yeah, it almost sounds like a catch-22 situation.
It is.
Yeah,
that's exactly what it is.
Where there's no power within yourself.
That's right. This is the kind of thing I'm trying to articulate.